Beyond Us and Them, podcast on radicalization in the times of social polarization. Welcome in the podcast of Resilience Through Education for Democratic Citizenship Project, called shortly REDE. My name is Filip Pazderski, and we come back to the discussion on how social polarization and radicalization threaten our democracies. Today, we will look again at how we can counteract these anti-democratic tendencies and violent radicalization. In this respect, we have with us Francesco Ragazzi today. Hello.
Hello.
It's nice to have you with us. So Dr. Francesco Ragazzi is Associate Professor in International Relations at the Institute of Political Science, Leiden University in Netherlands, and at the Centre d'études sur les conflits, liberté et sécurité, sorry for my pronunciation, in France. He has provided expertise on issues of security and counter-terrorism for the European Parliament, the Council of Europe, and the French Senate. So it's really very good that we can talk with you on this very important issues. And maybe if we can start with you telling us a bit about how you think important is such issue like violent radicalism and extremism in Europe nowadays, and also maybe what's your perception on that, how they manifest themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so well, first of all, thank you very much for your invitation on the podcast, and your pronunciation in French was very good. So
thank you.
That's a good start. Yeah, so when it comes to the importance of the phenomenon, I think we have to be careful because obviously, you know, especially since the attacks in London in 2005, the murder of Theo van Gogh in the Netherlands in 2004, there has been the emergence of this overall political concern for what we can call homegrown terrorism or radicalization. And the term radicalization really emerges out of a concern in particular from the perspective of security agencies for this new phenomenon. And of course, we've had terror attacks in Paris, in Denmark, in Belgium, in many other parts of Europe. However, when we look at the question of schools in particular, and what we looked at for our report is really at the level of the classroom, when we look at the question, how problematic is the level of radicalization of students in Europe? The answer is almost zero. So in a way, it's a reassuring answer. We don't have really a problem of radicalization in classrooms. That's not a concern of any of the schools that we went to. And we, of course, went to different kind of schools, but we went in particular to one school in which some of the students ended up leaving for Syria. So if you want, of the very, very few people who ended up leaving from Syria, one of the schools was part of our research. And even in that school, except for these one or two students, the vast majority, 99.999% of the students, were not concerned by questions of radicalization. So we really need to put this in the context. There is indeed, there are terror attacks. There is a broad political discourse about radicalization. The phenomenon is at the level of the entire Europe, the 500 million inhabitants of Europe, is in the few, I would like to say hundreds, that are of concern of intelligence agencies, maybe 1,000 or so at the European level. When it comes to schools, we're probably talking about a few dozen at the entire level of the European Union. So it gives us, I think, an important way of looking at the problem. a policy that is developed that concerns all students of entire countries for a few dozen cases that we're looking at. And so this is why in our report, we call this solutions in search of a problem, in the sense that there is pressure from the political level, there is fear that has been, of course, instilled by the terror attacks, and teachers have questions and educators have questions and school professionals have questions. But the reality is that it's an extremely marginal, if not non-existent for the majority of schools in terms of a problem.
Thank you. Maybe I should add also that because it is also important for the context why we are meeting today, is that you are also an author of the report, or one of the authors of the report for the Council of Europe. On,
yes, I'm sorry, yes. I should have introduced that earlier.
No, I also could have done this, but and this report is on counter-radicalization policies in the education sector.
Yes.
What with respect to that, I also wanted to ask you, what actually brought you to become interested in this issue? Could you tell us a bit more?
Yes, of course. I mean, I don't know if it will be very interesting for your listeners, but it has to do a little bit with my research interests and the trajectories. My PhD was about the role of migrant and diaspora communities during the wars in Yugoslavia. And I was in particular interested at the relation between bureaucratic categories and forms of identity. So how the formation of categories, for example, of suspects, of the category of the official diaspora, was generating and influencing forms of identification. So I came to the question of counter-radicalization from this perspective. I was interested whether or not or in what ways the new security measures that were considering an entire population, which is the Muslim population in Europe as potentially suspect, how that was having an impact on the ways in which, you know, populations that maybe were not identifying themselves as Muslim, because for a while in different countries, identifications were maybe in terms of occupation, you know, workers, especially in the 60s and the 70s when guest workers came to, you know, live in Europe. It didn't matter so much where they came from or what their religion was. It mattered that they were workers. Now in the 90s, it mattered that they were, you know, Arabs or Yugoslavs. And so they were more defined in terms of their ethnic and national identities. And I was interested in how the category of Muslim, we're speaking about the same populations, right? But now they were captured under the category of Muslim, which of course was a way to include them into a new reflection on multiculturalism on one hand, Christianity, as we see as a resurgent theme. And I think you're calling from Warsaw, and it's definitely an important a feature of some of the political parties in many parts of Europe, Poland, Hungary, but also other parts of Western Europe, in which parties are using identities in religious terms. And of course, I think what brings us today, how Muslim after 9/11 and after the homegrown emergence of the discourse of homegrown terrorism becomes then a relevant category for security practices, and this is how I came to the topic.
Okay,
sorry, a long-winded answer, but this is the explanation.
No, but very interesting, and probably the topic for another podcast. But let's leave it for then.
Yes.
Today I wanted to come back to your work and specifically to your report written for the Council of Europe.
Yes.
Because there you try to analyze different kinds of this counter-radicalization policies adopted in schools especially, and then you divide or like identify two kinds of these policies. So could you maybe explain what these kinds are and maybe what are their differences and similarities?
Yes, yes, of course. So, you know, schools are always sitting in a little bit of a strange position when it comes to societal issues, because on the one hand, the main role of schools, of course, is to provide education. There is generally a curriculum that's drafted at the national level, or maybe there is more autonomy and then schools can independently decide different modules and so on. And as far as the education is concerned, everyone agrees what the role of the school is. Now, increasingly, the school is being asked to solve all problems of society, right? So if there are drug problems, schools should solve it. If there is a knife crime problem, the school should solve it. If there is sexual harassment problems, then the school should solve it. And of course, you know, people working in school were not surprised that when there is now terrorism in society and homegrown terrorism is defined, even though it's maybe not matching with the actual numbers and the reality of the problem, but enough spectacular terror attacks are generating the idea that now this is a big societal problem and therefore schools should also solve it. And I think for school educators, you know, this comes on top of all of the other problems I mentioned, and without even mentioning the primary function of the school, which is to actually deliver the curriculum of education. So it was, I think, for many schools, the question of, we are already doing a lot of things, right? We are already doing education for democratic citizenship. We are already doing human rights education. These are two important principles promoted by the Council of Europe. We are already doing education against racism, against anti-Semitism. We are all already trying to do programs to raise awareness around violence and so on. Now, what do we do, right, with this new problem of counter-radicalization? And counter-radicalization comes, as I mentioned in the introduction, from two sides. It comes from the political level. The Ministry of Education is being told by the Prime Minister or the President, what is our country doing in terms of counter-radicalization? And now they need to come up with something. So there's a political priority coming from the top because it's considered to be an issue. Then there is concerns of the teachers themselves. Will I be responsible if one of my students ends up being involved in a terror attack? Do I have to report students? Do I have to tell the police? When should I start getting worried? If I see an ISIS flag on an iPhone of a 16-year-old, should I call the police? Who should I report to, et cetera, et cetera? So these problems really arise and there were legitimate concerns. Now, because counter-radicalization and the prevention of radicalization is so vague, and without even entering into the merits of radicalization as an academic concept, because in academia, it's extremely contested. A lot of people question that there is a process of radicalization. In fact, I would say the consensus now is emerging that this term, which primarily comes from intelligence agencies and then moves on to policy and then comes to academia, for most academics, they're very, very concerned about all the baggage that comes with this notion, the idea that it's a linear process, that there are stages, that you can intervene into the process at an early stage. All of this is very contested. In fact, it's much more complicated. And the narrative that underpins a lot of the prevention policies is flawed from a conceptual and also an empirical perspective. But we set that to the side. Schools had to decide, okay, what do we do, right? What do we do to tackle the doubts of our staff and also to say what the ministry asks us to do? And not very surprisingly, schools ended up doing all kinds of different things. We categorize them broadly in two categories, which we think are relevant to think about the impact they have on fundamental rights of students, because this is one of the big concerns we had. the, let's say, unproblematic type of policy we called awareness-raising programs. And to give a concrete sense to your listeners to what we're talking about, schools, you know, developed all kinds of techniques and activities with students to raise awareness around issues. So they do in-school workshops, they do role plays, they use, for example, alternative narratives. Imagine if aliens come here, who do they pick as different from the other, etc. They have extracurricular sessions in which maybe they visit an institution or they go to a police station or they talk with the social worker that comes to the schools. There are anonymous group sessions in which people can express their fears and students can exchange ideas. They can do field trips, for example, in areas where there is divided ethnic resentment. So going to visit, you know, a group, a school from the other ethnicity and figure out that actually you have a lot of things in common, summer schools. So these are all activities which we could call awareness raising because they don't have a direct impact on one individual student, but they are about raising awareness, bringing to the attention of students that there is a multiplicity of views available out there, that some societal issues can be understood at the level, at very different levels in schools from 5 years old to 16, 18 years old, depending on the exercises. And the question is for students to experience a particular form of, let's say, discrimination or violence or symbolic violence and so on. So for many schools, they thought, okay, preventing radicalization, it's similar to preventing racism, to preventing anti-Semitism. We know how to do that. We are just going to say that this is now tackling that problem. Other schools, or maybe sometimes the same schools, also implemented another type of policy or program, which we call casework. And casework is a term we borrow from social work. Which is to say, okay, we have particular individuals that we are worried about because we spotted, right, some signs that are worrying to us. And so therefore, there is some kind of assessment mechanism either given by the government or developed by NGOs or programs that are calling themselves de-radicalization or prevention of radicalization experts. And so therefore, there is a way to detect, right? This is the narrative. There is the way to detect the future radicals, the people who might become terrorists in the future. And you see already how problematic this kind of assessment is. And therefore, they are going to be referred. There is always the notion of referring a specific individual. And then the referrals can go in all kinds of directions, right? So you can maybe refer a student to an NGO. You can refer the student maybe directly to the police or to the intelligence services. Sometimes the police will refer a student to a school or to a program. All of them have different implications in terms of fundamental rights, in terms of protection of the child, in terms of fundamental values that are at the core of the principles of democratic education and human rights education. But there are a second type of category. And maybe to anticipate one of your questions, and I can develop later, the first type of programs, the ones we call awareness-raising programs, we see no conflict, no issue with the main values of the Council of Europe, which was the institution that asked us to look into the question. We see no incompatibility, in fact, perfect compatibility with the principles of the Council of Europe in terms of education for democratic citizenship and human rights education, and more broadly, and I think this is also important, for fundamental freedoms. Casework programs are a more tricky animal, if you want, because depending on what is being done, there might be actually very problematic issues when it comes to the primary interest of the child, the freedom of expression, the freedom to practice one's religion, and a certain number of other dimensions that can be absolutely problematic. I'm looking here. I see also, yes, the right to respect for private and family life, and also, of course, the freedom from discrimination. Because you understand very quickly that as soon as there is a referral, the question is, does it lead to a criminal prosecution? What is the type of evidence that is being collected? How does the school not become a police officer or takes the role of a police officer in that particular case? And then it becomes much more complex. But we can go into the detail also of it if you want.
Yeah, let's maybe jump into it straight away. Since you already started talking actually about weaknesses, especially about of the second type of this method. Maybe first I will ask if there are any more weaknesses, or maybe have you been able to identify also some weaknesses of the first type of the of these methods?
So what are the strengths and the weaknesses? I mean, it's very difficult, of course, because we're talking about programs that if they are done well, you won't see the result, because the result is something not happening. Right? The result is a person not becoming involved in a terrorist organization, or a person not becoming part of a right-wing extremist violent group, right? So if everything goes well, nothing happens. So very difficult to assess. And all kinds of prevention programs always have this problem in terms of assessment. So what you can assess is the program doing any damage? And I think this is one way to look at it. Of course, you can also look at, are there any particular competences that are being acquired and so on. It's obvious that the first category has the very broad advantage of actually raising important questions that are not only relevant for radicalization, they're relevant for living in society altogether, right? We should not discriminate. We should learn earlier on what it feels to be discriminated, and therefore developed not only an intellectual, but also a deeply ingrained reaction to discrimination. We should all learn that racism doesn't do for very inclusive societies, right? So all of the things that are included in the awareness raising programs, I only see benefits from it. It's very hard to see any disadvantage to them. In fact, maybe the only downside is that there are not enough of these programs. When it comes to casework programs, I understand why schools would want to engage in them, right? There is maybe a couple of problematic students. Everybody gets very worried about the students. Are they on a path to doing no good? And then what can we do about them? Well, here the question is, what is the role of the school in this regard? And where does the work of the school stop? And where does the work of the police start? And here, I think, therefore, we're entering into the question of what are the boundaries of criminal investigations? And what are the boundaries of what we could call the normal temporality of the criminal law process, right? So in a very schematized way, because maybe your viewers or listeners don't want to a whole lecture now on criminal law, but you know, it's very simple to understand. In the law, in our democratic societies, you first have to do something wrong. Then there is an inquiry to find out whether it was you, whether you did something wrong, whether you broke the law. And if you did indeed break the law, then there is a judgment and you are sentenced according to the type of deed that you committed. This is beyond the school system, but I'm just giving a little bit of context here. What we are increasingly moving towards is the subversion of the temporality of criminal law. And that is, well, we want to find out who will commit a crime before they even commit a crime. And we want to make sure that those individuals are under the control of the state and the repressive repressive forces of the state, that we are willing increasingly as a society to accept that the civil liberties and freedoms of those individuals that are, for now, that have done nothing illegal, but we think they might or we think they could, that those liberties are limited, that they are put under administrative constraints, under surveillance, maybe that their movements are monitored, their phones are tapped, and so on and so forth. And either they commit a crime and then they enter into the criminal justice system, or they don't commit any crime and we are fine with the idea that these people can be permanent suspects, right? And so, of course, it's not my idea. There's a very broad literature in criminology, in security studies, in criminal law, showing how administrative measures are increasingly becoming the way through which counterterrorism, counter-radicalization is being governed. People are put under surveillance and under a certain number of these processes. Now, that poses all kinds of questions when it comes to civil liberties and due process, of course, right? And more and more cases are coming to different courts contesting these powers, but there is a very strong push from security forces, intelligence agencies, to go into these directions. Not everyone in the security forces and agencies, but a substantial group of individuals and people who are pushing this agenda. Schools are part of this broader agenda, right? And therefore, the idea that comes from security agencies is we want to collect as much information as possible on as many students as possible in order to enact this logic of prevention. This is where the casework programs can possibly fit, depending on how they're implemented. But in Denmark, for example, we know there is a system called SSP, School, Social Works and Police. It's been in place for more than 15 years. It doesn't have a connection to counterterrorism, but counterterrorism now is one of the new missions of the SSP arrangements, in which systematic information is being given to the police from social workers and from schools. Now, in some countries, let's say like Belgium or like Finland, this would be completely unthinkable and going completely against many of the ideas about the strict autonomy of education with regards to police. So what we bring up here with the question of the casework are two main problems, two main drawbacks that we see. First, we enter into a logic of pre-crime. Students are considered often mistakenly, in fact, because the training of the teachers is very poor, very limited, mistakenly considered under the risk of being terrorists. In some cases, it's not all the cases that we saw, but in some cases, they are directly reported to the police or to the intelligence services. And then we know what happens, right? What happens is we have examples that are not from these studies, but from other colleagues doing research. In France, for example, the police comes knocking at the door of a student the day after or 1 week after they were reported. The whole neighborhood finds out that they are suspects of terrorism. The whole neighborhood calls them the jihadis, the terrorists, the bin Ladens, and then they have to basically, in some cases, move out, change schools because of the huge discrimination that emerges just from the fact of being under suspicion. They did nothing wrong. They are just under suspicion. But this has enormous consequences. So this is one big problem which we see with casework if it's not, if there are no proper safeguards, and there are ways to have some safeguards. The second problem we see is a profound breakdown of trust in the classrooms between the students and the teachers. Because if I'm a teacher in a classroom and I want to open up a topic Let's say I'm doing an awareness raising program. I want to open up the topic of antisemitism. I want to open up the topic of the Holocaust and talk about the Holocaust. And suddenly somebody in the classroom says, Holocaust doesn't exist. Okay. And then he says, the Jews are in control of everything and starts blurting out antisemitic things. As a teacher, I opened up a space for discussion. So am I going to now report these individuals to the police? Are they expressing their right-wing ideas, and are they going to become part of a violent group? So is this a police matter? Or actually, as a teacher, did I invite students to express their views? And the students are actually repeating ideas that they heard from their parents, from their environment. And precisely because they're expressing them freely and openly in the classroom, which becomes a trusted space of expression, they can experiment and they can be confronted to other ideas, in which then the teacher's role is to analyze the prejudice and explain why these are wrong, and not just shut the door and say, this is illegal or this is something despicable, get out of my classroom and now I will report you, but instead engage with the students. And we think generally the principles of the Council of Europe of education on citizenship and human rights is the one of creating trust, is the one of creating the possibilities for divergent ideas. And when you're 14, 15, 16, you have no idea most of the time what you're talking about, what are the consequences of what you're talking about. So our issue here is education needs a space of autonomy, right, from the police work. If this autonomy is broken, the trust is broken, and the safe areas for discussion and experimentation with political ideas that are then going to become the ideas of future citizens, right? Because in 2 or 3 years later, these students will be able to vote. And if what they get from the education system is their ideas are reprehensible and abject, which means their family is abject and their friends who think the same are abject, then, well, maybe they're going to think, okay, this school doesn't represent me. I will stick with my family's ideas and my friends' ideas, and I will vote for some parties that are actually telling me that the school is an intolerant place where we cannot express our ideas. So the biggest problem we see with casework are these two ones. The discrimination of the students, the entering into this logic of pre-crime on the one hand, and the second one is the logic of eroding the autonomy and making it impossible for students to develop safe spaces of discussion around issues that generally end up being categorized as radicalism.
I would be also curious to hear a bit about if the schools that you have been analyzing during preparing your report are aware about these drawbacks, especially of the casework programs, and were they able to develop some kind of answers to that, or maybe some kind of solutions, strategies, or maybe if not schools in general, maybe people working there individually.
Yeah, I think everyone is very aware of the problem. And in fact, the schools that we were able to talk to, most of them have a mitigation strategy when they are doing casework type of reporting. So let's say a first type of a strategy is not to report a student to the police, but to report a student to a trusted NGO. And so the NGO that maybe is composed of social workers, and depending on the countries and depending on the legislation, social workers have some privileges of confidentiality and therefore can work from an educational perspective for the interest of the students. And we think that this is an interesting way of approaching the situation. Maybe the school doesn't feel equipped to deal with the problem, but maybe there are social worker educators that are themselves equipped to deal with the problem. In the overwhelming majority of cases, they are not radicalization specific programs that are being called on. This is basic social work, right? Most of the times, these are teenagers who have problems at home, problems with the schoolwork, problems with the type of people they hang out with. Maybe they have addiction problems, and the ideologies of terrorism, jihadism, and so on are just one way to express this unease. So working with them, as any social worker would work with any teenager that is facing a particular tough time or crisis, then that's a way to go about it. We found another school, or actually a city, which set up a hotline for educators. And in that hotline, they were again reporting to social workers that were bound by confidentiality requirements. And I think that's very useful, because then social workers can provide answers and go into the details of the case and provide advice to the schools in a way that doesn't jeopardize the civil liberties and the different freedoms of the student. Now, when I say this, it should be very clear for your listeners that no matter the level of confidentiality and the level of privacy, if any individual involved in any of these processes hears of or is aware of something that could be a criminal offense, of course they're going to report it to the police, right? So we're not talking about people who are seeing criminality or who are able to see the preparing of a terror attack. Of course, though, in those instances, it's the duty of any citizen to immediately call the police, and that's what they do. But then there is really reason to worry. The question is, when we are in a situation where, okay, somebody watched a video that has some ISIS flag, it's not a criminal offense, but it's also worrying. So what do we do, right? So this is what I'm talking about. So this is the second option. A third option, which we've also seen, is cities and relations between school and police departments, because the police departments are also aware of the problem, right? Of course, not all the police officers are happy with this notion of pre-crime becoming the dominant paradigm in their profession, especially older police officers. They are very suspicious, and they think it goes against their professional ethics to engage into these kind of logics, and they also want to separate police work from educational work. So we have to be very precise. It's not something that all the police are happy to do, and so these officers, and maybe in countries where there is an attention to these questions of privacy at a very heightened level, the schools are invited to contact the police and on an anonymous basis explain what they are looking at and what they are seeing. So they are not giving the name of the student, but they're saying, we have a student who did this, this, and that. Would this be a matter for the police, or are we entitled to deal with it ourselves? And that, I think, also helps a lot. So there's all kind of what we call in the report gray areas in which the autonomy of education can be preserved while still getting very useful feedback and input from, let's say, the police or social workers or NGOs that doesn't jeopardize the different freedoms that I mentioned, which is the child's best interest as the primary consideration of any activity in relation to the child, the freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, the freedom of expression, the right to respect for private and family life, and the freedom of discrimination. These are all the rights and freedoms that are at stake when we talk about directly connecting information that is being collected in schools with intelligence services or with the police.
Okay, so let's move to the maybe recommendations. So basing on your findings on your study, are you in the position to say maybe what actually ideas, solutions should be undertaken that would be the best to counteract violent radicalism and extremism? Or maybe these are also these two, but they need to be organized in a specific way that you just already actually described.
Yeah. So I think there are two principles that we can put before any recommendation. And the first principle is one of the aims of terror organization is to limit our freedoms, right? So if in order to counter terrorism and radicalization, we decide to limit our freedoms ourselves, we are already doing something wrong, right? There is no amount of dictatorship and authoritarianism that is providing 100% attack-free society. If you look at dictatorships, they also experience terror attacks. So no need to curtail our civil liberties. There's numerous works about it. Restricting our freedoms doesn't increase security. It's not a trade-off. It's not a balance. More freedom means less security, and less security means more freedom. No, we can have both. But importantly, in our societies, freedoms and liberties are non-negotiable, right? They are non-negotiable, and we should be very, very clear that there are never good justifications to give them up. The second principle, and unfortunately, it's difficult to hear for politicians, and sometimes it's difficult to hear for school managers because they want to be seen as doing something specific, right? But in the very way in which every time there is a problem, the government tries to make a new law so that they are seen to be doing something against that problem. Just because there is now the problem of radicalization as a political priority, it doesn't mean we need to reinvent the wheel. The Council of Europe has 20, 25 more years of experience in developing tools and methods to deal with many of the problems that we are dealing here, that in the end are problems related to the definition of the other as inhuman, right? The discrimination against other religions and ethnicities, the violence, the segregation between students, anti-Semitism, racism. Our educational systems didn't wait until yesterday to do something against that. We don't need a new package. We don't need to reinvent entirely things. We don't need to subvert the order of our educational system to deal with issues that are, in fact, old issues, right? And so how, if you want, those two principles, I think, should be guiding the respect of fundamental rights and freedoms, and the idea that this is actually nothing entirely new, should be guiding the type of way we look at it. Awareness raising programs, I think, essentially are what is the best option. So paradoxically, what our report is saying is something that is very difficult, as I was saying, to hear for a politician, for a school manager. Keep on doing what you know how to do. No need to reinvent the wheel. Just don't change anything. Maybe adapt a little bit, because of course, society is changing and moving, and you need to change the vocabulary a little bit. But the techniques, the skills that educators have, the competences they've acquired along the years, the experience they have in dealing with students, those are the main engines that are going to do efficient work to prevent radicalization, as they did in preventing racism, anti-Semitism, and so on and so forth. Rebranding those programs as counter-radicalization is not necessarily a good idea, because it might, in fact, give the impression that they're doing something similar to the pre-crime work that I was mentioning earlier. So just keep on calling them what they are. Democratic workshops, anti-racism workshops, and so on and so forth. Casework is another situation. We saw that casework can potentially be very problematic. So my, you know, the recommendations that me and it's a co-author report I want to mention with Josh Walmsley. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this from the start. Casework is potentially infringing on civil liberties. So it should be dealt with a lot of caution. And there are many strategies, as I mentioned earlier, not to infringe on these civil liberties. And so I think any institution that wants to engage in casework should be looking at models in which the anonymity of the students can be preserved, in which the intelligence services and the police are informed only when strictly necessary. And also, I think the schools should be very aware that it's not their role to become intelligence officers. It's not their role to be informants for the police. They should look at the autonomy principle in order to understand where the boundaries of their role is. What is, however, needed, I think, at all levels is training for school managers, training for educators, so that we don't have an over-reporting and an over sort of preoccupation over what problems are. It's not because a student wants to wear the veil, or it's not because a student comes with a book in Arabic. These are two examples that are, you know, true, that these students should be reported for radicalization, right? It's obvious that there is, maybe I hope it's slowing down a little bit, but there is a hysteria, there is a mass panic about Islam and the relation between Islam and violence. And this mass panic also is affecting people in the educational sector with good and proper training in order to understand what the cultural values of different groups are, what the specificities of Islam are, but also, of course, all other kinds of radicalisms, right? When it comes to right-wing and nationalist radicalism, which of course we talk much less often because suddenly, you know, you have parties that come to power that have very radical political views, and therefore maybe they're not interested in being considered a radicalizing force and so on. But this should be done. So I think these are the main lines that I would recommend to look at when you're thinking about how to tackle the problem. And again, as I said, for me, the problem comes more from the fact that it has been put by politicians on the agenda, that it has been created as a problem that everyone should be aware of. Because in reality, the majority of the schools, the majority of the students will not be affected at all by the problem. And even in the schools where there might be a problem, it might concern one, two, maybe three students at most. So I think those particular cases can be looked at without a generalized program of suspicion in which every student that maybe has a darker skin color or has a name that doesn't sound like the name of the linguistic majority of the country, or maybe dresses differently, is immediately considered a potential terror threat. I think that's the biggest problem that we're dealing with.
So according to what you just have said, it's also not like that educators would need to get kind of like special support or like more extended preparation to do this work. They just can do what they have been doing for years, if not ages, actually. But you also mentioned that actually what they would need to get is the knowledge about radicalization, about Islam. Actually, it's specific character and features, but are there any more ways how we could support educators and social workers and maybe kind of competences that would need to be developed more than they are now, based on your findings? Or
I think another maybe way to look at it is that you know, we also have racism and intolerance among educators, so we shouldn't also take a naive perspective and think that teachers cannot be racist. So I think education against Islamophobia, against anti-Semitism, against forms of discrimination and racism for the educators themselves, so that they themselves do not perpetuate the very type of intolerance that we are trying to tackle at the level of the students, should be in place. I'm thinking of examples in France in which very, very narrow interpretation of what is the principle of laïcité or secularism have in fact led to discrimination against Muslim students. So yeah, if there's more to do, maybe there's also a little bit of introspection from the part of educators to do when it comes to their own prejudices and why they think that some students might become or might be a terror threat and so on. If we are looking at the broader structure, or let's say the broader environment in which schools are operating, as I said in the introduction, schools are under the pressure to solve all problems of society. And not only they're under pressure of solving all problems of society, but we're giving them less and less means, and the salaries are stagnating, and educators have to deal with everything on top of this now new problem of radicalization. So if we want also our school system to work properly, and to take on so many tasks, we should also give them the means to do that. The autonomy of the education sector can be guaranteed, and these safe spaces and these extracurricular activities can be made if there is enough time and if there are enough resources and if there are enough possibilities for teachers to educate themselves about these alternative forms of teaching and creating activities for the students. And in some schools, it's just not an option because they barely find enough time to just do the curriculum. So investing in the educational system as a whole, and in particular in these awareness raising programs, the possibilities for students to engaging them and for instructors to deliver them, means also questioning some of the pressures under which schools are put at the structural level. And this is also something we mentioned in the report. In institutional settings in which they are more and more squeezed for resources, this is also something that often gets cut out because there's just no time and energy to do it.
Thank you very much for this important, interesting observations. So maybe if we just can finish with any more specific example of the project adopted on the local level that you find very interesting and worth to be mentioned related to working in the educational sector, if there is anything like that. So please share it with us.
In our report, we reviewed eight schools and projects operating in schools that all, I think, had very interesting dimensions to them. We found very committed educators in all of them. So I would recommend your listeners to look at the report. We mentioned them in the methodological annex, but all of our report could not have been possible without their contributions, without them sharing their challenges, the solutions that they're trying to come up with, their hopes as to what their programs will achieve. So I think all of them are worth really looking at because they're generally extremely committed to what they're doing.
Okay, thank you very much. So maybe I would just mention the title of the report. It's just to be super clear. It's Counter-Radicalization in the Classroom, issued by the Council of Europe and co-authored by our guest, Francesco Ragazzi. Thank you very much for being and sharing with us today, Francesco.
Thank you very much. I just want to mention also the name of the second author of the report, Josh Walmsley, who was instrumental in writing this report together with me.
Of course. So thank you very much also for both of you for writing this report, and good luck for your next work. Yes.